Welcome to a deep dive, into the world of international disaster management. You shared some fascinating lecture notes with us, and I'm excited to kind of unpack those key insights together. I think we can all agree that disaster management is, much more than just reacting when a crisis hits.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really about understanding and managing the underlying factors that make communities vulnerable in the first place. As these notes point out, that's where the international aspect comes in. It's about nations and organizations working together to create a global safety net.
Okay, so let's jump right in. One of the first things that struck me was the emphasis on seeing disasters as processes, not just isolated events. Can you elaborate on that? Why is that distinction so important?
Yeah, think about it this way. A disaster isn't just the earthquake or the hurricane itself.
Right?
It's the culmination of long-term risks colliding with vulnerable communities. Poverty, unplanned urbanization, climate change, even conflict, all these factors contribute to a community's susceptibility to disaster.
So it's almost like a chain reaction where these underlying vulnerabilities magnify the impact of a hazard.
Exactly. There's a powerful quote from Ban Wing Kimun in these notes. Almost as dangerous as the cyclones or earthquakes themselves is the myth that the destruction and deaths they cause are somehow unavoidable. It challenges us to look beyond the immediate event and address those root causes.
That's a really thought-provoking way to frame it. It shifts the focus from simply reacting to disasters to actually preventing them, or at least minimizing their impact. And speaking of minimizing impact, the notes mentioned a really compelling example comparing Haiti and Cuba. They were both hit by hurricanes in 2008, but the outcomes were drastically different.
Yeah. The Haiti earthquake in 2010 was devastating, but what's often overlooked is that just 2 years prior in 2008, Haiti was also hit by four major hurricanes and tropical storms of quick succession. The death toll from those storms was staggering, nearly 700 people. In that same year, Cuba was also hit by powerful hurricanes, but they reported only seven deaths.
Wow, that's a staggering difference. What explains such a disparity in outcomes?
Cuba's long-standing investment in disaster preparedness. They've prioritized early warning systems, evacuation plans, and strong building codes. These measures, combined with effective land use policies, have significantly reduced their vulnerability to natural hazards.
So even when facing similar natural forces, the level of preparedness and the policies in place can dramatically influence the outcome. It's a powerful testament to the idea that disasters aren't inevitable and that we have the power to influence our own destiny.
Precisely. And that brings us to the disaster risk management cycle, a key concept highlighted in these notes. It outlines six interconnected phases, not just response and recovery, but risk assessment resilience, building readiness, and reconstruction.
It sounds like a more holistic approach, recognizing that disaster management is an ongoing process, not just something that happens in the aftermath of an event.
Absolutely. And each phase plays a critical role. For example, the notes mention the 2022 hurricane in Mozambique. Knowing a major storm was approaching, they proactively distributed cash assistance to vulnerable communities 48 hours before it made landfall.
So they were able to act ahead of time and get resources directly to the people who needed the most. That's incredible. What kind of impact did that have?
By empowering those communities to prepare, they were able to lessen the impact of the hurricane. People could secure their homes, stock up on supplies, even evacuate if necessary. It's a great example of how understanding the entire risk management cycle can lead to more effective disaster management strategies.
That makes perfect sense. Now let's talk about risk management strategies themselves. The notes mention a few different approaches: avoid, accept, reduce, transfer, and retain. Can you walk us through those a bit? Is it just about trying to eliminate risk altogether?
Not necessarily. Sometimes avoiding risk completely is simply not feasible or even desirable. The real focus, as emphasized in these notes, should be on risk reduction, mitigating the potential impacts and probabilities of a disaster. It's a proactive approach, kind of like the old saying, a stitch in time saves nine. Investing in preventative measures up front can ultimately save countless lives and resources down the line.
So it's about taking steps to lessen the blow, even if we can't prevent the event itself.
Exactly. That could involve anything from strengthening building codes to implementing early warning systems to improving disaster preparedness training for communities.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, I'd love to dive a bit deeper into the actual impact of disasters. The notes distinguish between direct and indirect impacts. Could you elaborate on those for us?
Think of direct impacts as the immediate consequences of the hazard itself.
Okay.
These are things like injuries and fatalities, burns, crush injuries from building collapses, drowning during floods. Understanding the most common causes of these direct impacts is critical for improving prevention measures.
That makes perfect sense. But I have a feeling the indirect impacts might be even more far-reaching, right?
Absolutely. Indirect impacts can be much broader and longer-lasting. We're talking about things like psychosocial stress, economic disruption, food insecurity, damage to infrastructure, and displacement of populations. These indirect effects often cascade throughout society and can even surpass the direct losses in terms of their overall impact.
Wow, that's really something to think about. It really highlights the complex web of consequences that disasters can trigger. It's not just about the immediate damage, it's about the ripple effects that can linger for years or even decades.
Exactly. And that complexity is further compounded by the sheer number of stakeholders involved in international disaster management. You have host governments, donors, international organizations like the UN and the Red Cross NGOs, the private sector. It's a massive network of players.
Coordinating all those different groups, each with their own mandates and priorities, must be an incredible challenge. How do you even begin to get everyone on the same page?
It's a constant juggling act. And the lecture notes actually highlight the difficulty of coordinating such a diverse group. They even mention the need to sometimes limit participation in meetings for practicality's sake, which just goes to show how intricate this work really is.
That's fascinating. It's a reminder that even with the best intentions, there are real-world limitations and complexities to navigate. And to add another layer of complexity, there's also the question of decision-making and accountability. How does that work in an international context where you have so many different players with potentially competing interests?
That's a critical point, and one that the lecture notes delve into. They point out the differences between national and international frameworks. On a national level, there's often a clearer hierarchy, but internationally, things get much more nuanced. You have all these different actors with varying levels of authority and responsibility.
So how do you ensure accountability in such a decentralized structure? And how do you balance the need for a coordinated response with the sovereignty of individual nations?
That's where things get really interesting. But before we jump into that, maybe it's time for a quick recap of what we've covered so far.
Yeah, a recap is a good idea. We started by talking about how international disaster management is about so much more than just responding to emergencies. It's really about understanding those long-term risks and vulnerabilities that set the stage for disasters in the first place.
And that powerful quote from Ban Ki-moon really stuck with me, the idea that disaster deaths aren't inevitable, that we have the power to change the outcome.
Absolutely. We also explored the disaster risk management cycle, those six interconnected phases that guide our approach from assessing risk and building resilience to ensuring readiness, responding effectively, and focusing on long-term recovery and reconstruction. It's not just about putting out fires, it's about preventing them from starting in the first place.
And the example from Mozambique was so inspiring, proactively distributing cash assistance before the hurricane hit. It shows how taking action in those early phases can make a real difference.
Exactly.
Then we moved on to risk management strategies, emphasizing that the key is often reducing risk, not just trying to eliminate it altogether. Investing in things like stronger building codes and early warning systems can pay huge dividends in the long run.
We also talked about the multifaceted impacts of disasters, both direct and indirect. It's not just about the immediate casualties and physical damage. It's about the ripple effects on mental health, livelihoods, and entire economies. Those indirect impacts can be truly profound.
Yes, and as we were just discussing, managing those impacts involves a complex network of stakeholders, each with their own perspectives, resources, and priorities. Coordinating that global response is one of the biggest challenges in international disaster management.
So let's delve into that challenge a bit further. You mentioned that the lecture notes highlight the need to sometimes limit participation in meetings just to keep things manageable. That really speaks to the sheer scale and complexity of this work.
It does. And when you add in the question of accountability, things get even more intricate. On a national level, you often have a clear chain of command. But in international disaster response, it's much more about collaboration and consensus building.
Which makes sense, given that you're dealing with sovereign nations, each with their own systems and priorities. So how do you navigate those different levels of authority and responsibility?
That's a key question and one that's constantly being grappled with. But before we dive too deep into that, the lecture notes actually bring up another critical element, the role of international operational support services. These are the specialized teams and resources that provide on-the-ground support during those crucial early stages of a disaster.
Okay, that sounds vital. Can you give us some specific examples? What kind of services are we talking about?
Think of them as the first responders of the international community. The notes highlight several key players, but one that stands out is the UN Disaster Assessment and Coordination Team, or UNDAC for short.
UNDAC, I've heard of them, but I'm not exactly sure what they do.
They're like the advance guard of the UN system. Within 36 hours of a major disaster, a UNDAT typically made up of 8 to 15 highly trained individuals is deployed to the affected area. They assess the situation, coordinate relief efforts, and help establish those on-site operations centers that are so crucial for managing the response.
So they're the ones who bring order to the chaos in those initial days, helping to create a framework for effective action.
Precisely. And they often work in close coordination with the On-Site Operations Coordination Center, or ONOCC. This serves as the central command post, bringing together representatives from various national and international agencies to ensure a unified response.
So UNDAC helps lay the groundwork, and then OHOCC takes over the ongoing coordination.
It's actually a very collaborative process. The UNDAC team often plays a key role in staffing the OSOCC, working alongside their counterparts from other organizations. It's all about creating a seamless transition and ensuring that everyone is working together effectively.
That makes a lot of sense. What other support services do the notes mention?
Well, in addition to UN de Berle, there's the International Search and Rescue Advisory Group, or INSERG.
INSERG, yes. I remember reading about them. They're the ones who coordinate those international search and rescue teams, right?
Exactly. They play a vital role in those critical first 72 hours after earthquakes and other disasters that involve trapped survivors. INSERG sets standards and guidelines to ensure that rescue efforts from different countries can work together seamlessly, which is essential for maximizing effectiveness and saving lives.
It's incredible to think about the level of coordination and expertise involved in these operations. It's like a global network of specialists coming together to tackle some of the world's most challenging situations.
It truly is. And it's not just about manpower and equipment. The notes also emphasize the importance of timely and accurate information in disaster response. That's where organizations like the Global Disaster Alert and Coordination System, or GDACS, come in.
GDACS, now that name rings a bell. They're the ones who provide those real-time alerts and information on natural disasters.
Right.
Exactly. Using cutting-edge technology, including satellite imagery analysis, they're able to assess the impact of events like earthquakes and hurricanes almost as they're happening. This allows them to quickly alert the international community and provide critical information that helps guide those early response efforts.
It's like having eyes in the sky, giving everyone a bird's-eye view of the situation. So they're essential for painting that initial picture of what's happening on the ground.
Precisely. In those early hours and days when information is often scarce and time is of the essence, GDACS plays a vital role in shaping the international response.
This is all so fascinating. It's amazing to see how technology is being harnessed to improve disaster response and coordination.
It truly is. And in addition to GDACS, there are other groups like AKPS Reach and Map Action that are dedicated to gathering and analyzing information during disasters.
Okay, I have to admit, I'm not familiar with those organizations. What do they do?
They all play a crucial role in providing the information needed to make informed decisions in a disaster. ACTS focuses on needs assessment, providing in-depth analysis of the humanitarian situation. RECH specializes in data collection, often working on the ground to gather firsthand information from affected communities. And as the name suggests, Map Action provides geospatial mapping support. Their detailed maps help responders understand the lay of the land, identify affected areas, and target their efforts more effectively.
So it's not just about sending in rescue teams and supplies. It's about having the right information at the right time to make sure those resources are being used as strategically as possible.
Exactly. Information is power, especially in a disaster. And it's important to remember that all these different services and organizations, from UNDAs and INSERG to GDICS and the mapping teams, are all ultimately coordinated by the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCH.
OCH, that's the one based in Geneva, right?
Yeah.
That's right. They play a crucial role in bringing all the pieces together, mobilizing resources, ensuring that all those different organizations are working in sync, and ultimately striving to create a cohesive and effective international response.
So they're kind of like the conductors of this massive orchestra of international aid.
I love that analogy. They're the ones making sure everyone is playing in harmony and that the music reaches those who need it most.
This is all starting to make a lot more sense now. We've gone from the big picture concepts of disaster risk management to the very specific services and organizations working on the ground. It's incredible to see how it all fits together.
It is. But as with any complex system, there are always challenges to overcome.
I can imagine. What are some of the biggest hurdles that international disaster management faces?
Well, as you might expect, logistical issues are a constant concern. Getting aid to those in need is often hampered by damaged infrastructure, limited transportation options, and the sheer scale of the affected areas.
And I imagine communication barriers can also be a major obstacle.
Absolutely. Especially in the early stages of a disaster, when communication networks are often down or overloaded, getting accurate and timely information can be incredibly challenging. And even when communication channels are functioning, language differences and cultural misunderstandings can hinder effective collaboration.
Those are all very real challenges. And then there's the issue of navigating different political systems and priorities.
That's another major hurdle. As we were discussing earlier, respecting the sovereignty of individual nations is paramount in international disaster management. But that can sometimes create tension when governments are reluctant to accept outside help, even when their people are in dire need.
So it's a delicate balancing act between offering support and respecting national autonomy.
Exactly. And finding that balance can be incredibly tricky, especially in the midst of a crisis.
The lecture notes actually provide a helpful diagram comparing national and international disaster management architectures. Can we take a closer look at that? What are the key differences?
Sure. The diagram highlights the fact that national systems are typically much more hierarchical, with a clear chain of command and well-defined roles and responsibilities. This makes sense as they're operating within a single unified system.
So they're more self-contained, whereas the international level involves a much broader network of actors.
Precisely. And that broader network introduces a whole new level of complexity. Decision-making processes are often more decentralized, relying on collaboration and consensus building rather than top-down directives.
Which can be both a strength and a weakness, right? On one hand, you have a more diverse range of perspectives and expertise, but on the other hand, reaching agreement and coordinating action can be much more challenging.
You hit the nail on the head. It's a constant balancing act. And while the international community has made significant strides in improving disaster response and coordination in recent decades, there's always room for improvement.
So it's a constantly evolving field, adapting to new challenges and learning from past experiences.
Exactly. And that adaptability is crucial, especially as we face a future marked by climate change, increasing urbanization, and the potential for new and unforeseen threats.
Well, this deep dive has certainly given us a lot to think about. We've covered a lot of ground, from the theoretical foundations of international disaster management to the very practical realities of coordinating a global response.
And I think one of the most important takeaways is that this is a field driven by human compassion and a commitment to helping those in need. It's about recognizing our shared vulnerability and working together to build a safer and more resilient world.
Absolutely. And speaking of shared vulnerability, the lecture notes actually end on a rather thought-provoking note. They raise a question without explicitly answering it.
Oh, I'm intrigued. What's the question?
They ask, how does the concept of sovereignty impact international disaster response?
Ah, yes. That's a question that goes right to the heart of one of the biggest tensions in this field.
Okay, help me unpack this. What's the tension?
On one hand, you have the principle of state sovereignty, the idea that each nation has the right to govern itself and control its own affairs. On the other hand, you have the urgent need to provide assistance and support to those affected by disasters, regardless of where they occur.
So it's a balancing act between respecting a nation's autonomy and fulfilling our moral obligation to help those in need.
Exactly. And there's no easy answer. Every disaster situation is unique with its own political, cultural, and logistical complexities.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
The notes don't go into detail about the specific challenges, but I'm sure there are many.
Oh, absolutely. Imagine a scenario where a country, for political reasons, is reluctant to accept international aid, even though its people are in desperate need. Or a situation where cultural differences or language barriers create misunderstandings that hinder effective collaboration.
And then there are the logistical challenges of operating in disaster zones, which are often chaotic and unpredictable. Damaged infrastructure, limited resources, security concerns, all of these factors add to the complexity.
You're absolutely right. Navigating these complexities while respecting sovereignty is a constant challenge for international responders.
So what's the solution? How do we balance these competing priorities?
It requires a delicate and nuanced approach, one that recognizes that every situation is different. Building strong relationships with governments and local communities beforehand is crucial. Having those lines of communication already open can make a huge difference when a crisis hits.
So it's not just about being ready to respond. It's about cultivating those relationships and fostering trust well in advance.
Exactly. And when a disaster does occur, Clear communication, transparency, and a willingness to listen to and respect local perspectives are paramount. It's about recognizing that effective disaster response is not just about top-down directives, but about empowering local communities to take ownership of their own recovery.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So while there may not be easy answers when it comes to balancing sovereignty and international aid, there are ways to approach these challenges with sensitivity and respect.
Absolutely. And it's an ongoing conversation, a constant process of learning and adapting as we strive to create a more effective and equitable system of international disaster response.
It's a reminder that even in the face of immense challenges, human compassion and ingenuity can make a real difference. But before we wrap up this deep dive, there's one more element in the lecture notes that I want to touch on. They briefly mention the concept of disasters as opportunities.
Yes. That's a fascinating and often overlooked aspect of disaster management. It might seem counterintuitive at first, but it's about recognizing that while disasters are undeniably tragic events, they can also create a unique window for positive change.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Mm-hmm. How so?
Yeah.
It does seem a bit paradoxical to think of disasters as opportunities, but I'm really curious to hear more.
Well, in the aftermath of a disaster, there's often a surge of political will and a heightened awareness of vulnerabilities.
You mean like a wake-up call that prompts people to take action?
Exactly. It's a chance to not only rebuild what was lost, but to build back better, addressing those underlying issues that may have contributed to the disaster in the first place.
The notes specifically mention the reconstruction phase as a key moment for seizing these opportunities.
That's right. Reconstruction isn't just about putting things back the way they were. It's a chance to reimagine and redesign communities to be more resilient and sustainable.
So it's about learning from the past and using those lessons to create a better future.
Precisely. The notes give the example of Tacloban in the Philippines after Typhoon Haiyan. The mayor at the time implemented a no-build zone along the coast to reduce the risk of future storm surges.
That's a great example. It shows how disaster recovery can be an opportunity to make fundamental changes that reduce vulnerability in the long run.
And it's not just about physical infrastructure. The notes also emphasize the importance of addressing those longer-term social and economic impacts during reconstruction.
You mean things like mental health support, economic revitalization, and ensuring that recovery efforts benefit everyone in the community?
Exactly. It's about recognizing that true recovery goes beyond bricks and mortar. It's about rebuilding lives and livelihoods, fostering a sense of community, and creating a more just and equitable society.
That's a powerful message. So while disasters present immense challenges, they also offer a chance for positive transformation, a chance to build back better and stronger.
Absolutely. It's a reminder that even in the face of adversity, there's always hope and the potential for a brighter future.
This has been such an insightful deep dive into the world of international disaster management. We've learned so much from these lecture notes, going from the theoretical foundations to the practical realities on the ground.
Yeah, we've explored the complex interplay of factors that contribute to disasters, the challenges of coordinating a global response, and the incredible work being done by dedicated individuals and organizations around the world.
And we've seen how a proactive approach, a focus on risk reduction, and a commitment to collaboration are essential for building a safer and more resilient world.
A world where disasters are not seen as inevitable, but as challenges we can overcome together.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into international disaster management. We hope you found it as thought-provoking and informative as we have.
It's been a pleasure.
And remember, even in the face of adversity, there's always hope and the power to make a difference. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and stay safe.